When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm your NBN host, Lavinia Stan, a professor of political science at St. Francis Xavier University in Canada. I'm talking today with Ryan Manucha. Do I pronounce well? about the book he just published in 2022, entitled Booze, Cigarettes and Constitutional Dust-Ups, Canada's Quest for Interprovincial Free Trade. Ryan is currently a fellow of the Brian Mulroney Institute of Government at St. Francis Xavier University, which has facilitated this interview. Named for its champion and main fundraiser, former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, and housed in a state-of-the-art complex. The Institute brings together public policy scholars from a variety of fields. It also offers an excellent undergraduate public policy program, the coordinator of which I was in 2019-2020. Welcome to New Books Network, Ryan.
Thank you so much, Lavinia. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for accepting this interview about your recent book, which was the 10th volume published by McGill Quinns in collaboration with the Brian Mulroney Institute of Government Studies and volume is featured in a series titled Leadership, Public Policy and Governance here at CentFX. Before we turn to the book, could you tell our listeners a bit about your academic trajectory for them to get a feeling of where you are coming from what brought you here today at this particular step in your career?
Absolutely. Yeah, it started back, I pursued undergraduate studies in economics at Yale University in the US. And there, my studies really helped me understand the basic building block in terms of tooling set for policymakers when it comes to understanding the rigorous econometrics and economic theory. And while I was there, I was blessed with opportunities to help with some research for professors and also some policy experience at the Ontario Securities Commission and at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C., at the within the Economic Trade Policy Branch. And so there I was really able to appreciate and learn a good deal about the rigorous, you know, maths and theory that goes into trade policy. And then after economics undergrad, I pursued a law degree at Harvard Law School, where I dove into the world of international trade law and studied under some very knowledgeable professors who sort of showed me the basics and more than the basics on international trade law and policy. And because of those two experiences, I was able to combine the economics and the law at once. And while I was at law school, that was where it was a really interesting moment in Canadian history when, I mean, we've had internal trade wars throughout post-Confederation history, but it was Alberta, this was in 2018 or 2019, trying to get bitumen out to the West Coast, and British Columbia saying, no, that's not what we want to allow. Essentially blocking the movement of this good, bitumen, out to the coast by way of pipeline. And in response, Alberta retaliated by curtailing the sale of BC wine in Alberta liquor stores. And being a student of international trade law and being a student of international trade economics, I was like, oh, this is utterly destructive for the Canadian economy. And how is this even permissible within a single nation state? And that was the spark of my journey and a deep dive and exploration and study of internal trade law in Canada. And in the study of internal trade law, or the study of internal trade, I should say, is extremely multidisciplinary. You're looking at, you know, various components of law. You're looking at constitutional law, administrative law, international trade law. And then, you know, you also have to look at Canadian political history and economic history. And then also you have to bring together that more empirical and mathematical economics to help understand the impact on trade flows and the costs to the Canadian economy. And not to mention a great deal of appreciation for the social and political forces at play, because, you know, as much as we may pursue internal trade for maximal economic growth, we may be also similarly or more concerned about things that may run antithetical to liberalized trade. For example, you know, environmental protection laws or public interest laws that curtail movement of goods or services for the public. May be important to us as well, not just maximal economic growth.
So you are a Canadian. I sense that you are actually from Ontario. Is it correct?
That is correct.
So your undergrad was in economics in the US. Why the decision to go to the US to study? Why not pursue an economics degree at the University of Toronto, for example?
There are so many incredible programs in Canada. I think I was really excited to learn in a different form. We might, you know, joke ourselves into thinking Canada and the US are the same. They're really not. And I really wanted to understand how the US, the psyche and the way that the United States self-organizes and has built. And that was especially the case at law school, where I came to appreciate how, you know, there we have, you know, the framers of Confederation in 1867. In the U.S., they have the, you know, they call them the founding fathers in the late 1700s. And how did they conceive of a federal system? How did they conceive of importing their own contemporary value set into what was coming from the British? And just understanding that, like, everything, the way that humans decide to self-organize really is so contextually determined, and it's good to understand how it's done elsewhere. And because of that, you can then really appreciate how your own nation self-organizes.
So I understand correctly that both in your economics studies and in your law degree, you looked at Canadian topics, and your professors were excited about these topics. How is Canada as a topic of study for students, for Canadian students in the US? How is it perceived?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely wanted to make sure I was learning a lot about the US because, you know, that's where their specialty is. They're able to sort of self-reflect and think. But then you take one really interesting example was a wonderful class I took under Professor Mark Tushnet on comparative constitutional law. And in that course, we explored the Canadian Constitution and a lot of how Canadian jurisprudence and the way that, you know, the Constitution Act 1867 and 1982 sort of frames Canada into being as sort of like a template or a model that could be used in certain respects and as another way of constitutionalizing a country. And the way that in this class, the Canadian framework was put up and elevated and raised and praised was pretty thrilling. So absolutely. I think there's a certain there's a great deal of respect for, especially at law school, the Canadian legal system. And, you know, it's different approaches. If we think about, you know, the drafters of Confederation in 1867, a lot of what they did was influenced because of the conflagration happening in the US, the Civil War. And a lot of those folks were saying, hey, how can we frame our country to avoid the same, a similar situation from occurring here? So there's always great opportunity to cross-pollinate, best-in-class experiment. And I think one thing that really resonated from the U.S. experience was legislative and, you know, political and policy experimentation. You know, they like to think of themselves as 50 different laboratories of testing. And it really plays out sort of seeing how 50 different systems under one federal framework can approach a similar issue and the various outcomes that come from it.
So the topics that you are interested, broadly speaking, you are interested in lie at the intersection of trade, economics, and law. Is this, would you say that this is a good characterization, or would you want to elaborate on it?
Economics, the law, and history, political science, it's so multifaceted. And I think what's so interesting is that, you know, we haven't really thought of Canada as a domesticated version of the international trading system. And we've realized over the course of, you know, especially the past 40 years, but, you know, more broadly speaking, let's say it's since Confederation, the upper limits of our economic union. And I think there's so much that Canada can learn from the way that other nations sort of handle their internal markets and the way that, you know, international structures have arranged global markets, and port that over for, you know, for our own domestic learning. And why do we care about internal trade? Like, internal trade's interesting, but why do we really care about it? You know, cost of living and affordability, for example, to the extent that we have internal trade barriers that augment the cost of the goods and services you and I buy every day, that's important. And if we can, you know, study internal trade barriers and identify causes and seek solutions, I think that's really important for everyone. If we care about the productivity of the Canadian economy, you know, Canada's productivity is falling off a cliff and is set to be one of the worst performers in the OECD very soon. And if we care about this and we care about national prosperity, you know, it's there's no one silver bullet. But I think a very important one is efficient domestic markets. And if we kind of perpetuate a system where we have provincial territorial fiefdoms and it's very protectionist and businesses can't be forced to compete and become stronger, and you know, you can draw the causal linkages, I think that's what we really care about. So, you know, internal trade domestically has a different flavor because we care about our collective prosperity. We all pay into a tax system and you know, wear the same uniforms and, you know, fight for, you know, one another, support each other with PPE during the pandemic. And, you know, we should think a little bit more carefully about our economic integration, too.
So I take it that some very urgent and important concerns are driving your interest in this topic. And this is the starting point pretty much of the book. Yeah, this is the foundation of the book. This was the question that you started to explore at the very beginning, yeah? And I think you mentioned some of the ways in which interprovincial trade is important for Canada. But if we were to compare ourselves with other federations, you would say that we are in a worst, we are erecting this walls between provinces, these walls are thicker in Canada than in other countries, or what's your comparative sense of federal trade in these countries? Where does Canada stay among in this ranking? You know, where does it?
Yeah, very valid question. And one thing that's so interesting is I love going back, like understanding internal trade now, you really have to go back into the past. And so we look back at 1867 and the drafters of Confederation, they really ported over what was a constitution from Great Britain, which was for a unitary state. It didn't have, subnational governments like provinces and territories. And so when you bring that over and you hope that it applies in the same way, you can run into some problems of interpretation. And very early on, the Privy Council in the UK, which was for the longest time our highest court until 1949, we had the Canadian Supreme Court, but the highest court of appeal was back to Britain. And they were very much very cognizant of this, how something unique had been created in Canada, and were very careful to protect provincial sovereignty. And that was something that threads through Canadian constitutional law very well up until, let's call it like the mid to late 20th century. I think more recently we've drifted, just totally looking at constitutional law, we've drifted into a zone of flexible federalism where I think that, the rise of the administrative and regulatory state is pretty, can bring for some very complex regulatory regimes, and sometimes they interact with the jurisdiction of another level of government. And, as we'll get into in this conversation, like, how do you manage that? And that is, especially when those can be the sources of trade barriers. But if back to your original question, how do we compare against other countries? There are a couple, you can compare Canada against, other federal states. That's like a category. But we can be more specific. We can say, Australia is a good comparator. Australia's got a similar economy, like really driven by primary commodities, oil, gas, minerals. It's got that same British heritage. It's got a number of social factors that find overlap. There's a significant role of for so there's a large urbanized population. Both have great exposure. They're both middle countries, greatly exposed to international trading patterns. And the way that Australia handled it is they legislated mutual recognition agreement into the fabric of their national legislative schema. So whereas Canada in the early 90s adopted the approach of a domestic trade agreement, Australia went even farther in saying, we're actually going to give this the level of legislation. We're not just going to create a political agreement, which I think is really powerful. And they even have a national body called the Productivity Commission that goes out and sort of sources these trade, identifies them, raises them for consideration, and draws focus and attention and political will. Compared to, the European Union, and the European Union similarly has a much stronger approach towards internal trade barriers. There's a very strong philosophy of mutual recognition that runs through the way that the European Union does business. And I think that's another model for Canada to sort of look at and see okay, what do the next 50 years look like for the economic union? I think the European Union is a good guidepost. And in the US is an interesting one. Obviously, it's got its own uniqueness. It doesn't have the same sort of, Commonwealth sort of setup, but it's also got a federal state. But I think what distinguishes the US in part is that it's got a much stricter judicial test for trade barriers internally. And I think that helps guard against, to a greater degree, internal trade barriers than in Canada. So I think Australia and the European Union are very good models for us to consider when we're considering comparative states of internal trade. Mm-hmm.
This is a compelling argument, what you laid here. I want to go back to the title, and I just wonder, are cigarettes and booze at the heart of interprovincial trade? Or this title is like a hook for the audience to become interested in the book. Yeah, let's explain to non-Canadian and Canadian listeners, what does this trade cover?
Oh, it's the booze, cigarettes, 100%. You know, Canada's internal trade story is really found throughout the products that we really care about, and things that didn't make it to that title, for example, include margarine. They include turkeys. They include a lot of booze, quite frankly, but eggs and chicken. It's all manner of goods, especially goods that could have also made that list, but booze and cigarettes definitely turn heads. So, and why do they matter? I think booze and cigarettes are subjects of trade battles, domestic trade battles, because governments derive a ton of revenue for their sale. And so where they can defend those markets, they are better off. And the most recent story of this was Gerard Cuomo, who his travels from New Brunswick to Quebec to go buy cheaper beer in New Brunswick, saying, no, we've got a our own system in place. We want you to buy booze domestically because they derive, let's call it $40 million in HSD and 120. I could be wrong on these numbers. I'm just instant recall here, and something like $120 million in profit to the province, which is money that goes towards, public health funding, education funding, like things that we really care about. So as much as we can be cynical, oh, this is just like a cash grab for the government, at the same time, yeah, it's a cash grab, but the cash is going towards like meaningful public services. So like you can't like ignore that. But it goes as far back as the first internal trade barrier case, 1921, era of prohibition. This time it wasn't so much about raising revenue, but it was about, what was moral back then. And you had the Prohibition era folks who were the teetotalers who didn't want the sale of booze, moral purity issues. And there were folks who did. And so, using booze as a way to, it was an internal trade barrier case, but it was really using that provision to see if they could get their alcohol in, notwithstanding the restrictions of temperance. Another instance, the 1940s Atlantic Smoke Shop case out in New Brunswick, about whether or not a province was able to charge a sales tax on cigarettes. Like, this was stuff that you and I like think about as like it's expected, like fully within provincial. But there were some in early Canada, a lot of things were still being figured out, including whether or not provinces were entitled to levying sales taxes. And so, anyways, in that case, it was really fascinating case that went all the way to the Privy Council in England and argued by a man who had, he was a well-known communist who was, had defended Ho Chi Minh in an extradition case. And here he is essentially like the side he was essentially arguing for was the side of, let's call it big tobacco. They were trying to prevent these taxes from being layered on at the prohibition. And so, like, it's an interesting side for him to take. Anyways, he was the lawyer on the case. But it really is about the things that we care about. And they like, we get margarine is another one. Margarine was invented in France in the 1800s to deal with a food crisis. And you have a ton of dairy farmers in southwestern Ontario for whom margarine was a real threat to their dairying. So they were doing all they could in the late 1800s to essentially write it out of existence. And they used the criminal prohibition powers to sort of say, hey, we're not going to deal with this. And people, you can look at the debates back then. There was a lot of arguments about health and safety. But what it really was, this is threatening the dairy industry. This, margarine being sort of a manifestation of internal trade barriers, and it represents local interests seeking protection. I mean, even until very recently, it was difficult, if not impossible, to buy margarine in Quebec, and it had to be of a white color. It couldn't even look attractive; it looked like lard. So yeah, 100%. It's such a rich history inside of our products, especially the ones that, are very have very inelastic demand curves if we pull the economic parlance out too.
Let's be very as specific as possible because when I have to mention that Ryan gave a talk here at SentFX, and I was quite amazed at find out that if I cross from Nova Scotia, I'm a resident of Nova Scotia, and if I cross the border to another province to buy, pretty much you are saying margarine, butter, booze, cigarettes, timber, furniture, cars. Is that also applying? I will have to pay some extra, or I won't be able to import to bring back to my province certain products, depending on the legislation, yeah, or the choices made by the provincial government where I'm residing. Is this what happens?
That's exactly it. Internal trade barriers, they used to be really evident, you know, a tariff, a customs duty. You would see border agents at the border of Upper and Lower Canada monitoring the passage of goods and, you know, trying to ensure that everyone, you know, before 1867, there were a ton of intercolonial trade barriers. We don't see that anymore. You don't see, if you're trying to bring wine in from Quebec, it's a 7% tariff. First of all, that's not allowed. But that's not the type of trade we're talking about, really technical and non-tariff trade barriers more generally. And so, you know, for Comeau, it was a prohibition on the reentry into Quebec with more than 12 bottles of beer at the time. It can be even more subtle. Like that one was a bit of an overt quantitative restriction, but, you know, it was kind of premised on public safety or, you know, whatever the argument they might have tried to raise. If, you know, right now, another example, in order for a truck that's overweight or oversized to travel across, every province needs its own permit. And, you know, if you're going from, you know, Nova Scotia to Alberta, that requires, I think, like 7. And if you're going from Texas to Alberta, it's 1. They don't require one in every state. You know, the inability for, you know, you have trailers the backs of trucks that they drag, trailers, and needing registration or needing to renew registration every time you enter into a new province. Another good example is the porting of qualification. If you're a doctor and you've been licensed to practice in a particular province of Canada, trying to port those qualifications over. And it's, you know, sometimes, if you do this test, if you pay that fee. But what Canada needs to recognize is like every one of those, anytime you introduce a friction to movement, you know, that's what we're talking about here. We're not like these glaring like border guards. It's not what, if you talk to many, you know, economic actors, you say, hey, you know, do you encounter trade barriers in your day to day? Oh, no, I don't do that. But they'll say, okay, so if you try to move your tow, can you move your tow truck from Ontario to Quebec? Say, oh, well, I know it's, you know, it's exceeds the weight limit. Or, you know, can you, you produce meat out of your provincially regulated factory in Alberta. Can you get that over into Saskatchewan? You say, oh, actually, no, not without going through this, you know, federal abattoir. It's like not recognizing that what they're encountering is a trade barrier and sort of accepting it as a cost of goods. And the biggest thing that's surfacing is that it's in the data. The trade barriers are in the economic data. But folks on the ground don't use the vernacular of trade barriers when they discuss what they're encountering. They think of it as, you know, I don't know, just again, cost of business. And for smaller businesses who can't afford to handle the compliance or the financial issues related to those decisions, like, you know, trying to bring your car over from British Columbia to Alberta. If you already just had your inspection done, why do you need to have your inspection done again in Alberta? Like, there's something about us being under one common citizenship that I think entitles us to a degree of, you know, mutual recognition of the standards and the testing procedures undertaken in one province as satisfying those in another.
Well said. And you bring all these examples and many more in your book, which is a very dense book with no fewer than 15 chapters. Could you please walk us through your argument and the way the chapters are building on each other for readers to understand the various how you construct your argument in these 15 chapters?
Well, so I started a lot of my early research in internal trade had to do with the jurisprudence that was coming out of this super new internal trade court called, doesn't have a name, but it's the venue where disputes over Canada's internal trade agreement are heard. There have been 13 to date, 2 that have gone on to appeal. And there I was trying to discern what was going on and the case law that was unfolding and trying to help guide future panelists and judges on how to decide future cases. But I realized like so much, you know, a lawyer appreciates the origins of a law. And understanding how we got to where we are now and the institutions that exist really require starting from the beginning. And that really comes from, in my book, the 1840s, because you need to understand the Constitution. And in order to understand the Constitution, you need to understand the people who were drafting it. What were their life experiences? What had they endured? And 2 big things relating to internal trade were the abrogation of the U.S. from the Free Trade Agreement in 1866 and the repeal of imperial preferences by the British in the 1840s. So within everyone's lifetime who was party to drafting the Constitution had been massive shocks to Canadian trade flows. And so from there, we understand the Constitution, how it exists. And then we follow the course of Canadian constitutional, political, legal history to the present day. And we understand, you know, we look at the case law in, you know, the butter and the cigarettes and the booze and the interpretations of the Constitution. And then, you know, overlaying all of this, the book delves into, okay, well, how was economic thinking evolving over this period of time? And how was Canadian federalism evolving over this period of time? And what becomes apparent is that by the time you get to the early 1990s, which is when we got our first internal trade agreement, it was sort of stars had aligned. We'd had, and so in the book, I argued like it was at that point in time where it was possible to make the kind of decision to enter into an internal trade agreement as we did. And, you know, I discuss, you know, it was the right time politically, domestically and abroad. There was the necessary competence at federal and provincial governments. We'd just been through 10 years of nonstop negotiating international trade agreements. There was a great degree of capacity in provincial and federal governments. And then once we establish the timeliness and the need for an internal trade agreement, I then bring the reader forward and I say, how has it worked? We've had 30 years of operation of this agreement. How has it worked? What's the diagnosis and what's the trajectory? Where are we heading towards? And so using this you know, time continuum, arguing like, okay, here is how the constitutional law is likely to evolve. And that's where I get to in my book. And I have some predictions for the next 20, 30 years. But then I also underscore that a lot of the internal trade barrier resolution is going to be done through Canadian intergovernmental collaboration. And it's because of what we talked about earlier. The Constitution gives so much power to the provinces and to the federal government. And trade barriers can't be comprehensively understood until you have a mechanism that helps with that overlap. And it's a really creative solution. You know, world's first wholly intergovernment, like the only country who essentially took what the WTO has and it domesticated it. And so we're first in time on this. And there isn't a lot to learn from other nation states. We can learn from the WTO. We can learn from bodies like NAFTA and Mercosur and the EU and the EC. But we're learning a lot on our own. And so I think what I also argue is now is a good time to reflect. And given everything about, you know, our drive for, you know, our productivity falling off a map and domestic competition at level. The Competition Bureau recently came out with a stunning study that showed the absolute falling off of another diminishment of competition within Canada. So a lot of reasons to refocus and think about how internal trade is important for so many reasons.
Thank you very much. This was very good to have this outline of your argument. You know, after you completed this project, what do you think are the main lessons that Canadians and possibly others might draw from your book? It seems to me, for example, that although there is an argument there to be made that the government, through all these the fees and you know that they collect, they can cover other social programs, it seems to me that it's very cumbersome. It's very cumbersome for us, the ordinary people. Yeah, it might be good for the government, but it's another way of taxation in a way. It's another way of making payments to the government that might not be as glaring as as your income tax when you have to when you know what the or how much the government is taking out of your income, you know. So what would you say are the most important lessons?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's take another example, workers' compensation. It is very difficult to get workers' comp coverage if you're not from that province. And so what does that do? Like, it makes it very difficult for companies to reallocate and redistribute labor workforces for, you know, folks who are, or, you know, for opportunities that require that kind of workers' comp that you can't get under the current scheme. Like, overall, like, the matching, like, if I think of as an economist, the matching of supply and demand is hindered when you have this structures like workers' comp or for example, occupational health safety differences, differences in regulation, and meaning that like only the really big companies can afford to monitor and handle 13 different regimes. And so it really benefits large entrenched established players who, you know, may have justifiable reason to want to continue these kinds of barriers, right? It strengthens their position. They're the only ones who can navigate the fairly complex terrain. And, you know, you can get into the argument about like regulatory capture and the relationship between, stakeholders and the regulatory process to maintain, competitive moats through laws and rules. I think some of the big lessons for us is that like it's exhausting work. And we're talking about like the reconciliation of divergent building codes of construction of electrical codes. But if you take this is where I think where Canada needs to go is like appreciating that like these internal trade barriers sort of are redefined, and we need to open our minds up to like what could constitute a hindrance for our overall prosperity. And again, you may want restriction that, and I think any regime like Australia's internal trade mutual recognition act, you know, the way that the EU does it, they always allow for legitimate policy reasons to prevent the application of liberalized mechanisms, right? Like in Australia, they'll say, oh, you know, if you're certified for this occupation in New South Wales, you're certified, you're able to practice that occupation in Queensland. But they do say, oh, except where, you know, this might impact health, safety, or the environment. Like they are mindful of legitimate policy reasons for wanting to impose restrictions. But in those cases, there's always guardrails in place. So Canadians need to expand the dialogue and help industry and government appreciate how wide ranging and how subtle trade barriers can be. And then also appreciate that reconciling them, we're talking like with construction codes, we started diverging along very different paths as early as the early 1900s due to like local events like fires, floods, whatever. And then, you know, insurance companies would come along and say, okay, now you have to build your buildings this way or that way, you know, as a result of like local events. And all of a sudden you then had very divergent building codes over the course of many decades as one contributing factor. I'm sure there are others. And so appreciating that like it does take time and sustained engagement to, you know, either, you know, to reconcile and to harmonize these different regimes, or if we're going to pursue this alternative model, which is called mutual recognition, where, you know, you say, I'll recognize the way that you guys do it and say, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for us. That one requires the building of trust, because in order to do that, you kind of have to have confidence in the way that, you know, I have to believe that the College of Teachers in Nova Scotia, you know, certifies and trains teachers to the same standard as I would expect Ontario. Once you hit those thresholds, it's very easy to have those levels of understanding. So, so the second point of this to summarize is it's a gradual and incremental and some could say taxing process, but it's worth it. And I can show one data point on why it's worth it. The reconciliation of building codes across the country, you know, they've estimated the savings to be about $1 billion a year. Like, if you talk, if you like take your business or economic, you think about the return on investment, and you can like really model out the cost to reconcile and weigh that against the benefits, the future benefits, and bring those, discount those into the present. And the calculus will weigh in your favor. And where it doesn't, you can reconsider. But, you know, it's a lot of hard work, but, you know, Canadians are all the better for it.
So it seems to me that your argument is for change, in favor of change, that in Canada, various actors need to realize that interprovincial trade barriers, at least some of them, are more detrimental than, you know, than helping us. And then if change is necessary, which one would be the main actor responsible for this change? Because, I mean, definitely the government must regulate, yeah? But it seems to me that, at least for now, corporations are hurt by the government. The government has its own interests at heart to collect this money. But consumers, for example, or professionals, or maybe the civil society or the society in general is not well organized. Or what's your perspective here?
Yeah. So I'd say two things. One is from the role of the federal government. Like, if we think that like every single trade barrier costs that person $1, and they're like, oh, $1, that's fine. And a province says, okay, there's 100 people dealing with a dollar trade barrier, that's okay. It's $100. The federal government is almost the only body in a position to say, oh, it's $100 in Ontario, $100 in Nova Scotia, $100. They can collect and aggregate and sort of, you know, aggregate the costs spread across so many and use that and their central coordinating powers and their functions and their jurisdictional powers under the Constitution to be able to drive at change that like a single province may not really see as acutely as the nation as a whole. So the nation, like the federal government, can coordinate efforts when like the costs, you know, disparately are small, but when, you know, taken together, they're a massive ding to the economy. And so they're well positioned for that. The second thing, more directly, to, I guess, to your question is, let's take the case study of both Canada on the reconciliation of construction of building codes and Australia in the arrival at a mutual recognition agreement, and even back in the early 90s, and even Canada in the arrival at an agreement on internal trade in the early 90s. The most important factor, I think, was the role of industry and business groups at ensuring there was sustained pressure on political leaders. Because internal trade barriers always cross jurisdictional lines, they cross ministries, they touch on everyone with any amount of power. When you're trying to reduce an internal trade barrier, generally speaking, you are saying someone's turf is going to get smaller because we're trying to limit regulation. And that hurts. Like, and without that forcing function coming down from up top, and that forcing function getting fueled by business stakeholders and business and industry, you don't have that sustained momentum and willingness to make change, because it is so easy and preferred to not rock the boat. If I'm an internal trade official and I know that, you know, what I'm recommending is going to shrink the scope of like five other regulators with under various ministries, I'm not so inclined to pursue that. Like, I need that. The political guidance and direction is going to become fundamental in that scenario.
Would you say that COVID impacted in any significant way interprovincial trade barriers, or was it not so important?
Yes, I think that it definitely really hindered internal trade liberalization, I would say. And one of the ways it did so was we started to see subnational and local governments, and even national governments, but mostly subnational governments, essentially prefer local businesses, even, you know, notwithstanding the public procurement obligations under the Canadian Free Trade Agreement, to maintain the health and the vibrancy of their businesses within their jurisdiction, starting to consider that. The other consideration was a lot of the regulatory folks who are ordinarily tasked with matters regarding internal trade suddenly spent 2.5-3 years on COVID-related regulatory issues. And so it really set us back by a number of years, I think, because either, you know, there's finite time and capacity, and COVID regulatory matters came to the top. And so it, so just internal trade issues kept dropping down as a result of priorities. So it did have an impact. For example, I mean, we haven't seen the addition. So the Canada's governments maintain this list, this roster of internal matters for resolution, trade barriers that are, you know, under consideration for resolution. And not a single one was added in the past calendar year. And I think that there are a number of reasons for that, but I think one is just the diverted attention to other things.
If you were to reissue the book, a second edition of the book, would you change anything? Would you add more information? Would you give up some arguments? What would you say? What's the plan here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that one of the things I probably would have done more of would have been perhaps like expand more, kind of back to one of your questions, actually. How does this play out in other countries? Like, can you help us understand Canada in context? Like, how does this work in Switzerland, in Brazil, in, you know, and, you know, the book speaks to it, but it doesn't have as big of a comparative lens. And so maybe this is for, an annex or something, but I think helpful contextualization of how Canada does this, and not just because I talk about the constitutional scheme, but like more broadly, how does the internal trade market stack up against our global competitors, our trading partners.
So is this comparative study your new project? Or what kind of projects do you have on your desk for the near future?
On my desk right now is a lot of research on so standardization. Like, there's two ways that you can achieve trade. I'm looking at giving policymakers as much specific guidance on how to operationalize trade liberalization. Like, how can we actually solve this in specific scenarios? Like, I think we need a bunch of case studies. We need a bunch of examples. We need like playbooks to run on like the hundreds and thousands of trade barriers that exist. And like, how do we handle this? Because, you know, the framework's existed for 30 years. Canada hopefully exists for at least another, you know, many hundreds of years. Like, how can we build a model that grows, you know, and how can we reform and improve the institutions that we have? So, you know, for example, I'm creating, you know, research and writing on how we can reform the dispute resolution mechanism, or how we can bring better understanding and use of other devices to liberalize trade. How can we get creative about this, essentially?
In the book, you say that you have four brothers. Are you four brothers, or you are one of the four, or you have four other brothers? And my question is, did they like the book? Did your parents like the book? And what did they say you should change in the book? Did they make any suggestions, or they provided some of the cases, some of the examples that you are working with?
Yeah, I have three brothers, and I actually have to give credit. They definitely gave a lot of constructive feedback and guidance. I think one thing that they were really helpful with was ensuring that I didn't go down rabbit holes and go insane during the writing process. I'm sure you've had folks in your ecosystem who, especially my wife, who ensuring that you know writing and research is it's a marathon, not a sprint. And but also just feedback and guidance on the arguments, the construction, and not trying to get too specific, stay at like a level where you're advocating for change and not getting too far into one particular issue. Like they kept pulling me back, hey, what's the bring me back to the story, right? Because I think what I was trying to do, what the gap in the literature when I was writing this was something that brought together the whole story in a multidisciplinary fashion. And so just helping me remain true to that vision.
That's great. Our guest today at New Books Network was Ryan Manucha, the author of Booze, Cigarettes, and Constitutional Dust-Ups: Canada's Quest for Interprovincial Free Trade, published in 2022 by McGill Queen's Press. Thank you, and hope we'll talk again soon with your new book. When it will get published. Goodbye. See you, Ryan.
Thank you
Goodbye.
so much.